This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we're enlightening you with verses 218 to 219. From the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innallazina amanu wallazina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. الذين آمنوا والذين هاجروا وجاهدوا في سبيل الله أولئك يرجون رحمة الله أولئك يرجون رحمة مت الله والله غفور رحيم يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات الْآيَاتِ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَفَكَّرُونَ.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Surely, those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men. And their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. Israeli airstrikes and artillery fire kill scores more civilians in Gaza as the death toll from the regime's genocide nears 33,200, mostly women and children. Islamic resistance in Iraq carries out new anti-Israeli operations targeting two barracks and a base in the occupied Golan and the occupied Palestinian territories. And the World Court is set to begin hearings in a case brought by Nicaragua against Germany, accusing Berlin of facilitating Israeli genocide in Gaza through giving arms to Tel Aviv. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Israel has launched fresh airstrikes and artillery shells on Gaza, keeping the Palestinian territory in a state of catastrophe. Six civilians were killed in the regime's aerial attacks on a commercial facility south of the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza. Israeli warplanes also hit a group of people in a town near the southern city of Rafah, killing at least one and injuring several others. In Gaza City, six dead bodies were recovered from under the rubble of a house that was bombed by the Israeli military. The death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza since October the 7th stands at nearly 33,200, most of them women and children. The genocidal campaign is now in its seventh month, despite international calls to end the bloodshed. The U.N. Humanitarian Coordinator for Palestine warns that the Gaza situation is simply catastrophic. International aid organizations have decried the colossal death toll from 6 months of Israel's onslaught in Gaza and other devastating effects that it has left on the besieged strip. The World Health Organization chief said this would remain a stain on all of humanity. Tedros Adhanom said the denial of basic needs, food, fuel, sanitation, shelter, security, and health care is inhumane and intolerable. The International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies described the situation as, quote, beyond catastrophic, with millions of lives at risk of hunger. It warned that humanity has been all but abandoned. The Secretary General of the international medical charity Doctors Without Borders says international humanitarian law is being violated on a daily basis in Gaza. He has described the worsening situation in hospitals across the besieged territory.
We are definitely seeing rising rates of malnutrition. We are up to the in the situation in places like the Al-Aqsa Hospital, which is in a middle area of Gaza. We're in a really critical situation where our medics there are having to choose between giving beds to trauma patients who are seeking assistance and medication and surgery for some horrendous wounds, versus giving those beds to malnourished children. So we're absolutely seeing rapidly increasing rates of malnutrition. Firstly, there needs to be much more supply coming in, much more land crossings opened. And at the same time, that needs to, what we need to be aware of is that it's much more than counting trucks across the border. And a lot of the the narrative that we have seen in terms of supply in this conflict has been oversimplified, and actually moving supplies around the Gaza Strip is critical. Being able to have medics who are qualified, fed in a mentally fit state to be able to treat patients is essential for providing humanitarian assistance. And hospitals, if I look at it from a hospital perspective, are obviously more than four walls and a roof. They're about running water, electricity, fuel, communication. And just on international humanitarian law, there are now 200 aid workers that have been killed in the Gaza Strip. There was the tragic incident from the World Central Kitchen just this week, which has brought attention to this issue. But international humanitarian law is being broken on a daily basis in the Gaza Strip.
A cancer-stricken Palestinian prisoner has passed away, aged 62, after spending nearly four decades in Israeli jails. Walid Dakat died on Sunday at a hospital near Tel Aviv. He suffered from chronic lung diseases and was diagnosed with bone marrow cancer in December 2022 as a result of decades-long detention. Dakat's condition deteriorated further due to severe pneumonia and kidney failure reported in March of last year. The Palestinian Prisoners Society has attributed his death to medical negligence and Israel's policy of slow killing against sick inmates. Dakat was arrested in 1986 and remained behind bars under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy, in which a person is held without trial for an indefinite period of time. According to prisoner groups, Israeli jail authorities frequently delay checkups and urgent surgeries for Palestinian inmates. Clashes have broken out between Palestinian resistance fighters and Israeli occupation forces in the occupied West Bank. The resistance fighters have reportedly destroyed an Israeli bulldozer in eastern Nablus during these clashes. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has targeted three Israeli military sites in the occupied territories in response to the regime's massacres of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The resistance group announced that it had struck an Israeli barracks in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights using a drone. The group added that it had also targeted another barracks as well as a military base in the occupied Palestinian territories. The resistance group underlined that it will continue to target Israeli positions and interests in solidarity with Gazans, who have been under incessant Israeli attacks for more than 6 months. In recent months, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israeli targets. It has also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria, in retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The International Court of Justice is set to hear Nicaragua's genocide case against Germany for supporting Israel. Nicaragua has accused Germany of facilitating the commission of genocide against Palestinians by supporting Israel's war in Gaza. It hopes that the case, if won, would suspend Germany's military assistance to the Israeli regime. The preliminary hearings will take place today in the Dutch city of The Hague. The court will likely take weeks to deliver its decision. Germany is dealing with a similar situation domestically as well. Hundreds of German civil servants have called on their government to cease weapon deliveries to the Israeli government immediately. Iran's foreign minister says Israel is caught in the Gaza quagmire as the regime has achieved none of its goals in its war on the Palestinian territory. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a presser with his Omani counterpart in Muscat. The Iranian foreign minister said Israel is following the policy of warmongering and escalation in the region. He added that Washington has always fully supported Tel Aviv's warmongering policy. Amir Abdollahian also pointed to Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. He noted that the U.S. cannot shirk its responsibility for its support for Israeli crimes. Amir Abdollahian said that Iran is an island of stability and security in West Asia, adding that the Islamic Republic will not allow anyone to violate the country's national security. The Omani Foreign Minister Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, for his part, said Tehran and Muscat will work together to find solutions to regional tensions, including the Israeli aggression against Gaza. Following his visit to Oman, Iran's foreign minister will travel to Damascus as part of a regional tour. Turkish police have detained dozens of protesters demanding an end to the country's trade ties with Israel. Footage has gone viral of Turkish riot police violently forcing protesters into vans in Istanbul. Turkish activists said protesters were also tortured. In public, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been severely critical of Israel, even comparing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Adolf Hitler. Turkey, however, continues to export a whole range of products to Israel, including explosives, aircraft parts, and weapons and ammunition. On the streets, tens of thousands of Turks have been holding anti-Israel rallies during the genocide in Gaza. Earlier, we discussed the issue with Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger, who joined us from New York. He told us that Turkey, under Erdogan, is an opportunist state and will continue its trade ties with Israel.
President Erdogan is a character who's extremely shrewd. You know, he has a basic ideological opposition to Israel and Zionism that he's going to state, but as you say, he's going to continue business as usual. Look, Turkey's exported something like $320 million in goods to Israel since this year. That includes weapons and ammunition. Many countries were normalizing relations with Israel, were absolutely accepting the Zionist project as a fait accompli, and I think Turkey was willing to do that as well. You know, the United States, Joe Biden can get up and say, it's horrible what they're doing, and then give them weapons to do it. You know, they're going over the top with this. They have to stop killing Palestinian civilians, but here are your bombs to do it. And, you know, the spokesman for the National Security Council and for the State Department can get up and say, after what we saw at the Flower Massacre and Al-Shifa Hospital and the killing of the World Central Kitchen workers, we don't think Israel's doing anything that's against humanitarian law. So you have this phenomenon, again, of countries that are playing both sides against the middle and trying to figure out where this is going to go. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, I think Turkey is one of them in that respect.
Let's say rallies and marches have been held in cities across Canada. Participants in the rallies call for immediate end to Israel's genocide in the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent Camila Escalante reports from Toronto.
Thousands came together for the annual International Quds Day March in the Canadian city of Toronto to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially those in the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian solidarity organizations and communities rallied across from the U.S. consulate, calling on Ottawa and Washington to act urgently to end the Israeli terror campaign and genocide and try to save as many lives as possible.
And this year it's especially important because people are motivated to come out in large numbers to bring an end to this genocide that's taking place in Gaza and underline their commitment to see a free Palestine from the river to the sea and a free Al-Quds, a free Jerusalem, free from Zionism and occupation.
Millions around the world are marching yesterday, today, and tomorrow, all week. Thousands of cities and towns across the globe are making Al-Quds Day an international day, a call for justice and freedom, particularly for the Palestinian people as they are facing genocide and war crimes in Gaza.
The city has continued its heavy policing of pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Just 1 week ago, several participants were injured and six others were arrested in the annual Land Day commemoration by the Toronto police, who were captured on camera using excessive force.
So last week, people must have seen the videos by now, but the police completely attacked a peaceful rally, and there was horses involved, and this is what the police do. They're on the side of the Zionists, they terrorize people. You know, a protest, a simple, peaceful protest, you're not allowed. I mean, this is another example of the Palestine exception. That protest is good, it's a liberal, you know, it's a sign of democracy, except when you're talking about Palestine. You can't do that.
Participants also use Quds Day to condemn a recent deadly attack by the Israeli regime on Iran's consulate building in Syria's capital, Damascus.
Well, Iran has been subjugated to all forms of aggression at the hands of the Zionist regimes and their backers. But the last crime that Israel have done in destroying the Iranian embassy in Damascus, that is a zero tolerance. Iran will respond, and I think that Iran is being called upon by the people to respond against this Israeli aggression.
As the targeted killing of civilians and the starvation campaign continue, a temporary resident visa program announced by the administration in Ottawa 3 months ago has failed to bring to Canada any Palestinian relatives of Canadians from Gaza. Against that backdrop, families and activists are pressuring for a real arms embargo on Israel. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
The World Food Program is reporting a staggering increase in malnutrition cases in Afghanistan, especially among children, amid economic sanctions on the country. The authority says admissions to clinics for malnutrition have tripled over the last year in the capital, Kabul. Press TV's Rahmatullah Bakhwan has more from Kabul.
Afghanistan is now battling an invisible foe that threatens its future generations. The World Food Program has sounded the alarm on the rising tide of malnutrition cases, a crisis worsened by the country's ongoing economic challenges and reduced international aid. Marking the World Health Day, the Taliban's Minister of Public Health expresses concern over the malnutrition crisis, calling for international support.
It is clear that Afghanistan is one of the poor countries in the world. There is no doubt that children and mothers are grappling with malnutrition. We need the support of the world in combating the disaster. I call on the UNICEF, WHO and WFP to continue their assistance to our people with poor health conditions, especially those suffering from malnutrition.
The impact of international sanctions and the U.S. policies cannot be overlooked in understanding the gravity of the situation. That is a warning by pediatricians here in Afghanistan. Years of conflict have severely damaged the country's infrastructure, making it a challenge to provide adequate health care and nutrition to vulnerable groups. Moreover, recent cuts in international assistance as well as the Western-led sanctions are worsening things.
There are also some foreign factors exacerbating the malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. Afghan assets that belong to Afghans and are meant to support our economy are frozen. We are witnessing a decline in international health assistance, especially to our children. Some international bodies continue to collaborate, but these are not sufficient. Some organizations that used to support families have ended their missions in Afghanistan.
A lot of people like me are coming to this hospital because their children are malnourished. I think everything boils down to a single problem, economic shortcoming. If our family had enough to eat, our children wouldn't become undernourished. People don't have money and they're not receiving aid anymore.
Experts emphasize that the need for immediate aid cannot be overstated. Afghan families are in desperate need of assistance to combat this malnutrition crisis. The international community must come together to provide the necessary resources and support to save lives and alleviate the suffering of the Afghan people. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is taking a toll on the health and well-being of the war-ravaged nation. Advocates warn that without a significant increase in support, the crisis will further deepen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him. And everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willest, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Years, 30 days. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So, the ulama that are Muslim scholars took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet,
Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. Dear listeners, in this episode of this Ramadan series, we are going to focus on Ayah 104 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran. This ayah is about insight and deep realization of religion and requirements of time and age. Stay tuned, please. The days of the blessed month of Ramadan are the best opportunity to contemplate on ourselves and the philosophy and meaning of life with regards to the circumstances of modern world. Definitely, improvement and perfection in every human aspect requires full awareness and information on the path to move in. God says in Ayah 104 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran, "Certainly insights have come to you from your Lord, so whoever sees, it is to the benefit of his own soul, and whoever remains blind, it is to its detriment." Some of the great lexicographers of Arabic language believe that the word basirat, insight, is the belief of heart in a religious issue or a reality. Some others have described it as a smartness and admonition. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Nahjul Balagha, "Indeed an insightful person is he who hears and thinks, looks and attains foresight, then is admonished, so moves in the clear path and avoids falling in precipice." If one is insightful, he will be able to see near and far environs, just as we should be careful not to fall in precipice and traps in spiritual and social affairs too. We have to take care not to be deceived or go astray. Once a man called Ishaq ibn Ammar came to the 16th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, and told him, "I have a neighbor who performs prayer a lot, helps the needy, and goes on Hajj pilgrimage very much. I have not seen any wrong from him. What kind of person is he in your opinion?" Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, asked him, "How is his insight?" The man answered, "He's not that aware and has no insight in religion." The Imam answered instantly, "So he will not gain high rank with these worships either." An insightful person can recognize various currents and encounter them vigilantly. He can discern the plots of enemies and choose his duty towards them. God says in the Quran that faith is the most important factor to attain insight. Insight is the means to differentiate between good and evil, between right and wrong. God-wariness strengthens insight and helps the person to act smartly and wakefully. He will thwart the plots of enemies. The father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had an exemplary insight due to his God-wariness. When he was on exile in Neufchâtel Château, in the outskirts of Paris, he would not accept private meetings with various personalities, saying, "We have no private place." He used to hold meetings with several persons to witness the whole meeting so that no word would be decreased or increased to the talks. This is what today is happening through compound war and media war. This is called media literacy and considered as a part of insight. Therefore, insight is like having eye in confrontation of various events. Masoud Rajavi, head of the MKO terrorist grouplet, asked for a meeting with Ayatollah Beheshti, who was the judiciary chief in early 1980s. Ayatollah Beheshti accepted his request. Rajavi announced in a meeting that the MKO members were ready to pay allegiance with Ayatollah Beheshti, provided that he accepts their conditions. Martyr Beheshti told him, "Our difference with you is not a superficial difference. It is rather a deep difference originated in basic beliefs. My argument for you is that you don't even know Marxism." Then he read out part of Karl Marx's book, Capital, German, and translated it. He said to Rajavi, "If you refer to the original German book, you will notice that there are many fundamental mistakes in definition of Marx's economy. You have mixed principles under with the name of Islamic economy and Marxist economy and have found your ideology on this basis. This, while you should have recognized, acted, promoted, and explicated Islam according to its own principles." This very erroneous perception of Islam caused MKO terrorists to murder over 17,000 innocent people in terrorist operations, most of whom were ordinary men, women, and children. One of the most indelible stains in the MKO record was the terrorist blast in which Ayatollah Beheshti and over 70 of the companions of Imam Khomeini were martyred. The more one reflects on the ayahs of the Quran and the statements of the Prophet and his infallible progeny, the more he or she will gain insight and the power to analyze events and conditions. We are duty-bound to think deeply on various events and affairs. This will help us to come to a clear conclusion instead of being trapped in hollow and poor analysis. Weak analysis has been the pitfall of many societies and personalities throughout history. Zulkela was among the companions of Imam Ali, peace upon him, but owing to lack of insight, he was deviated and joined Muawiyah's camp and then became one of his commanders. Although he was fighting in front of falsehood, he thought that he was struggling for God and defending truth. Seeing the Prophet's loyal companion, Ammar Yasir, Zulkela remembered the words of the Prophet when he said, "Ammar will be killed by a rebellious lot." This was going to shake him and that of the many of the deceived forces in Muawiyah's camp as they could see Ammar on the other side. When Muawiyah noticed this hesitation among his camp, he immediately answered Zulkela, "Who knows whether Ammar will stay with Ali and not join us?" Lack of insight and deep ignorance caused Zulkela to be convinced and stay with the rebel, Muawiyah. He was killed. Ammar was martyred after him to clarify the truthfulness of the Prophet and rightfulness of Imam Ali and his companions. Muawiyah was happy as Zulkela was killed before Ammar because he knew well that had he seen Ammar's martyrdom, half of the Muawiyah's troops would have joined Imam Ali. This is ignorance and stupidity which extinguishes the light of insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be asking why the Zionist lobby and US warmongers are so exercised by who owns TikTok. The Chief Abu Chakra has discovered some surprising information about who TikTok has appointed to influential positions within the company, and she's filed this report.
A combination of US warmongers and Israel lobbyists are pushing the idea that because TikTok is owned by a Chinese company, it must be spying on and manipulating young people into, amongst other supposedly deplorable things, supporting Palestinians against genocidal Zionism. Well, TikTok, rather than being a hub of Chinese espionage, seems to be packed to the rafters with former US intelligence and NATO employees. Content policy lead for TikTok Canada, Alexander Corbeil, is simultaneously the vice president of the NATO Association of Canada. Aiche Kochak spent 3 years at NATO before becoming global product policy manager at the company at TikTok. Feature policy manager Greg Anderson worked on psychological operations for NATO until 2019. Beau Pateson has been working as a threat analyst for TikTok's Trust and Safety Division. Previously, Pateson was a targeting analyst for the CIA. Victoria Makalo previously worked for the Department of Homeland Security and for the White House. She now works on trust and safety at TikTok. There are many more. The latest escalation on TikTok began in the early stages of Israel's Gaza genocide, when a recording of Jonathan Greenblatt, head of the lobby group and spy agency ADL, was leaked. In it, he lamented what he called the Gen Z and TikTok problems. This was a clear signal that the genocide lobby was joining the anti-TikTok campaign. Now the US Congress has issued a warning that TikTok must be purchased by a US company within 6 months, or be banned from the country. Pro-Israel former Trump official Steve Mnuchin is gathering investors under his umbrella to buy TikTok. It is unclear if the investors will include his close friend Yossi Cohen, former director of Mossad, whom Mnuchin previously asked to join his other investment fund for Arab states. If the US was concerned about espionage against it and the protection of data, surely Larry Ellison's Oracle would not store key classified Defense Department data. Ellison did, after all, offer Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu the directorship of the company, and is also one of the largest donors to the Israeli occupation forces in history. Nancy Pelosi even went so far on CNN as to state that Benjamin Netanyahu attempted to interfere in the US elections. The United States does have a threat to its sovereignty, but it isn't from China.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul's AM University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is the celebrated British-Iraqi hip-hop artist Loki. He hosts the Watchdog podcast for Mint Press News that investigates secretive organisations and powerful vested interests. He's also a regular contributor on other media outlets like Double Down News. In recent years, he's gained a reputation as a cerebral commentator on international affairs in general and the crisis in Palestine in particular. And he's joining us today from London via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, why is it, do you think, that who owns TikTok sort of enrages both the United States hawks and the Israelis so much?
Well, the reason, the main reason, of course, is because young people use it. And young people are, in particular, virulently pro-Palestine. And yeah, that's what they don't like. They can't stand the fact that that overwhelmingly, if you look at TikTok, the messages that you get are pro-Palestine. There's hardly any, by comparison, pro-Israel messages, despite the best efforts, one, of the Israelis in trying to flood it with messages, and two, TikTok itself in trying to regulate the algorithm. So it's because they are losing on TikTok. So, of course, they have to find a way to explain that, and the way to explain that is to say, oh, it's the Chinese. Chinese doing this. No, it's not the Chinese. We know it's the State Department people who are running it. People from the high echelons of the American national security apparatus are in there. It's been shown conclusively. So what they don't want is for there to be a massive outpouring of pro-Palestine content on social media, and they can't regulate it because it's done by young people who they don't understand and can't control.
Mm. And yet they've said, haven't they, that it's got to be bought by an American company, haven't they?
It's already not owned by a Chinese company. The whole thing is an absurdity.
Yeah, it's really strange, isn't it? Anyway, but low-key, it's not only those supporting Palestine, is it, who actually use TikTok?
Well, Israel now finds itself in an interesting position because on one hand, it incentivized and encouraged its soldiers to do TikTok videos, quote-unquote, thirst trap videos, to try and beautify the image of the Israeli occupation forces. But what that led to also was Israeli military personnel sharing evidence of their own war crimes on the app, which were then entered into the ICJ submission for South Africa. And so in a way, it's a double-edged sword for Israel. On the other hand, what they also saw was people across the world using it to unpick the propaganda that Israel was pumping into the atmosphere. And TikTok, it was argued by Israel lobbyists, was somehow advantaging or algorithmically encouraging pro-Palestinian content, when actually those that attempt to use TikTok will find quite the opposite is true. Many pro-Palestinian accounts have been banned from TikTok with very little explanation.
Well, David, I mean, Latifa there mentioned the Anti-Defamation League in her report, otherwise known as the ADL. I mean, this organisation, we've mentioned it on the show numerous occasions. I mean, they pop up all over the place, don't they?
Well, I mean, people talk about how AIPAC buys political candidates in the US. Well, yeah. The AIPAC isn't the only element of the Israel lobby. The ADL is a key element, has been for over a century now. And it's a spy agency. It's there to spy on pro-Palestine protesters or Muslims or anyone who is critical of the state of Israel, and sometimes even those who were critical of the state of South Africa under apartheid were spied upon by the ADL. So it's there to sabotage pro-Palestine movements, and of course it's what it's doing in relation to TikTok. It's trying to encourage this idea that this is a Chinese company or that it's too pro-Palestine and to try and undermine it. So it's the spy wing, the sort of open spy wing of the Israel lobby in the US.
Mm-hmm. Well, low-key, what kind of methods then did the ADL use to pressure TikTok?
I think it's important to understand that the line is not clear where the ADL begins and the US security state ends. So the ADL is very much a product, though it has far deeper roots, of course, but in its present manifestation, a product of the bilateral security state between the US and Israel. It has a revolving door between it and the FBI. Several high-ranking figures in the ADL have come directly out of the FBI. And in fact, James Coney, at the time the head of the FBI, said the relationship between them and the ADL has never been closer. The ADL is actually the largest non-governmental trainer of law enforcement in the US. But the way that they mobilized around TikTok was very interesting. They made use of well-known Hollywood Islamophobe Sacha Baron Cohen, who has for many years been involved in the making of films which have buttressed the stereotypes that alienate Muslims across the Western world. But they mobilized him and sent him to TikTok to try and bully the platform and threaten them with this allegation that TikTok was responsible for the greatest increase in anti-Semitism since the Nazi regime of World War II. Patently false, complete rubbish. And of course, the ADL benefits from very close relationships with the creme de la creme of Hollywood and US celebrity, the US celebrity world. But they are also in a situation where they are becoming increasingly desperate when faced with the wave of pro-Palestinian feeling in the shadow of the Zionist genocide in Gaza.
Mm. Well, of course, the ADL were involved in a similar shakedown, weren't they, against Elon Musk?
Yeah, there was a sort of backwards and forwards, wasn't there? They sort of threatened Elon Musk with this advertising boycott, and advertising revenues precipitously declined, and Musk then went to Israel with Netanyahu and came back and said he was very impressed by all that, and then started to make moves in the Zionist direction. But he also said that he wasn't going to give in to this advertiser boycott, no, which he was meaning the ADL's boycott. And it was a sort of another bit of to and fro, and then of course he gave in, and there's been various signs that they're X, or Twitter as it used to be called, have been giving in to Zionist demands and implementing those demands across the platform.
Mm-hmm. Well, Loki, I mean, how does all this fit into the wider war against China then?
Well, the United States has 400 military bases situated around China. It has US forces on an island controlled by Taiwan that is just a few miles from the Chinese border. They have been constantly elevating the propaganda against China in the US media, and they have been seeking to take measures to build sacrificial lambs throughout the West. Of course, China is the number one trading partner for the vast majority of Western countries, including this one and including the United States. What this is about is the US being the number one producer in the world for over 100 years, and then that mantle moving to the Chinese. But of course, we have to remember that before the founding of the East India Company and the initiation of the British Empire, which spanned at its zenith over 14 million square miles of the planet, both China and India represented a far, far, an exponentially larger percentage of global production than the United States or Britain ever did. And so actually the British Empire established a sort of disfigured global order in which this tiny place was able to use other territories in the world, not only for captive labor, but also for free resources and also captive markets. And so it was that way that you had the development of Anglo-Saxon supremacy throughout the world. But China is pushing back the clock on all of that, and the world is returning to a more natural economic equilibrium. So the United States is doing everything it can to try and push that back, with the US military industrial complex leading the way. So TikTok fits in very clearly into that order of events, and it is really swept up as a moral panic, this idea of TikTok corrupting children, for one, but also to TikTok supposedly being a site of foreign espionage. Yeah.
No, indeed. Well, look, we'll come back to our discussion in a moment, because we've got another report now about TikTok's links to a pro-Israel company, which in turn is linked to the CIA.
The idea that China is spying on US citizens via TikTok becomes even more ridiculous when you discover that the data gathered by the company in the United States has actually been diverted to pro-Israel CIA cutout company Oracle as part of a massive deal known as Project Texas. The Oracle company was founded by Larry Ellison in 1977. The firm adopted the name of a CIA operation, and the first service it provided was helping the intelligence agency build a database. Oracle later hired David Carney to head its Information Assurance Center. Carney had previously been the third highest ranked employee at the CIA, where he had worked for 32 years. Today, Oracle is the world's second biggest IT software company, and Larry Ellison is the seventh richest person in the world. He is still the top shareholder in Oracle and works as the chief technology officer, as well as sitting as the executive chairman of the company, despite passing the role of CEO to Israeli Safra Katz. Larry Ellison was also instrumental in Elon Musk's bid to buy Twitter, providing him with $1 billion to pursue his takeover. Less well known is the closeness of Ellison, and in fact, the whole company, to Israel. Over a period of a decade, Ellison donated over $26 million to the Israeli military. The current CEO of Oracle has explicitly stated the company's pro-Israel bias. Safra Katz exclaimed, "We're not flexible regarding our mission, and our commitment to Israel is second to none. If our employees don't agree with our mission to support the state of Israel, then maybe we aren't the right company for them. Larry and I are publicly committed to Israel." The extent of the company's relationship with Israel is even more clearly seen in the report that Ellison even offered Netanyahu the position of director at Oracle. Project Texas also led to an influx of agents from the U.S. security state into TikTok, like Rebecca Pober, who went from her post at the Pentagon to become a U.S. policy manager at TikTok. The company's head of data public policy for Europe is Jade Nestor, who was the State Department's Director of Internet Public Policy. Another interesting individual at TikTok is recruiting coordinator Katrina Villacisneros, who was part of Army Cyber Command, the U.S. military unit that oversees information warfare online.
I see Larry Ellison was mentioned in that report there, David. Just say a word or two, will you, about him and his links to Israel.
Well, you couldn't make this up, could you? I mean, this is the seventh richest person in the world who is the runs the second biggest IT firm in the world. And the company says that it will not even tolerate employees who think differently about the Zionist entity. And they can go elsewhere and work for another company. And the process by which they are involving themselves with TikTok is the process that they've done in many other companies. They have massive contracts, of course, in the UK as well. And what we see then is that the data which they are managing for in these contracts are this data which is, you know, which is clearly available to Israeli intelligence. So this is a massive, massive scandal. And whenever we talk about this kind of thing, people say, "Oh, this is nothing to do." But this is a real scandal. That actually, this is an Israeli intelligence operation to penetrate the data systems of the largest organizations in the world, including governmental organizations, which have a national security component. The fact that they're now penetrating TikTok as well as many other companies, and that they're putting in place people who are ex-US spies and from the US national security apparatus is truly astonishing. But, you won't find this in the mainstream media at all.
I was going to say, where is the corporate media then?
Nowhere.
How would you explain that? I mean, it's very odd, isn't it?
That's a much longer answer you could ask me to do. But you know, the media, of course, are structurally opposed
as we've actually touched on in previous shows. But Loki, how does Oracle then go about obtaining contracts here in the UK?
Well, the interesting thing about Larry Ellison is that he is also a component of the campaign against Elon Musk and Twitter, because, of course, he borrowed Elon Musk $1 billion. In order to buy the platform. In addition to that, Larry Ellison is so close to Benjamin Netanyahu that even though Ellison is supposed to be a prosecution witness in the eternally delayed corruption trial that Netanyahu must undergo when he's finished genociding Gaza, Ellison has met with Netanyahu several times on his private Hawaiian island, and he even saw to it that his own lawyer and the lawyer of Israeli intelligence agent Arnon Milchan, another supposedly prosecution witness in the trial, was given to Benjamin Netanyahu for the trial. So all manner of corruption and conflict of interest seem to be at play here. In terms of domestically, Oracle stores the data for the British Ministry of Defence, for the Home Office, for the British Foreign Office, and even for the British National Health Service. Now, the very month that Larry Ellison's company obtained this massive contract with the British government, you had the cancelling of Larry Ellison's Ellison Foundation charity, which operated here and employed the father-in-law of Boris Johnson, who was at the time the Prime Minister, as its head. And you know, Boris Johnson's father-in-law received £500,000 wage per year from Larry Ellison's charity at the same time that Ellison was employing other British government high-ranking employees. At the same time, he was vying for a contract from the British government. To me, that's an open and shut case of conflict of interest.
Well, a bit of a rhetorical question now then, David, but do you think any of the data that we've discussed is safe in the hands of Larry Ellison and Oracle?
Well, I mean, from the outside, you can say that obviously people will be sceptical of that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, what do we have? Do we have any kind of due diligence from the Ministry of Defence, from the Foreign Office, from the Home Office? These are, of course, the three government departments in the UK which are responsible for all of the intelligence operations of the British state, for GCHQ, MI5, MI6, and all the rest of the military intelligence as well. So this is an open and shut case of a national security problem, which the national security establishment of the UK steadfastly refuses to face. Mm-hmm. It simply won't look at it, and you've had what effectively are massive bribes to senior civil servants, and indeed to the former the Prime Minister's father-in-law. I mean, this is an extraordinary situation. Mm. There should be a public inquiry on this in the UK, but there's not a whiff of it anywhere in public debate.
No, indeed. So, I mean, it's not only the media falling down on the job, but the politicians who are supposed to be holding these sort of organisations to
account. And the intelligence agencies. The intelligence agencies should be leading an investigation of this.
Sure, indeed. Well, Loki, I mean, are we seeing an antagonism developing, do you think, in the relationship between China and Israel?
Well, this is a fascinating question, Chris, because immediately after October 7th, the Chinese government refused to condemn the operation. In addition to that, Israel, since the beginning of its genocidal campaign in Gaza, has charged that China is unofficially operating sanctions against Israel on the dual-use civil and military exports, which normally are sent from China to Israel because they just haven't been coming in. Now, supposedly, there is a bureaucratic reason behind it, but Israel is convinced that China is targeting it. In addition to that, when Israel cancelled the work permits of 65,000 Palestinian construction workers in the aftermath of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, what you saw was Israel seeking to fill that gap with 100,000 Chinese workers. The Chinese government then banned its citizens from going and working in Israel. We know that around 30,000 Chinese citizens were working in the Zionist entity prior to October 7th. At least 20,000 of them have left. And what we also know is that during this time, perhaps as revenge for the unofficial sanctions issue, you have seen the Israeli port of Haifa, which previously was controlled by a Shanghai corporation. The Chinese had invested a huge amount of resource in developing the Haifa port. It's now, during this period, fell 70% under the control of an Indian billionaire. So there certainly is some level of antagonism developing within the Israel and China dynamic, for sure.
Well, David, I mean, what sort of impact then do you think there would be with a kind of fallout in the relationship between China and Israel in the region there?
Well, we already know what some of the impacts have been. We already know that the Chinese brokered the deal between Iran and the Saudis, which also helped to end the conflict in Yemen,
yeah,
and put Yasser Arafat in the position of being able to enforce a boycott of an embargo on the Red Sea. We already know that the Chinese have been behind the overtures between the Syrian government and the Saudis, and indeed by Hamas and the Saudis, and indeed with Hezbollah and the Saudis. These are all massive changes in the region, which mean that the region is moving away from having to separately fight Israel, and indeed are moving in a direction which means that China will increasingly come to be seen on the side of what effectively is the resistance axis. Now, it's not doing that openly as yet, but the overtures it's making are having the consequence that actually fighting between the Arab nations is being decreased, and that of course means that there will be an increased confrontation with the Zionist entity.
Another indication, perhaps, of the end of the unipolar world and the emergence of the multipolar world, something we'll probably have to come back to on another show, because unfortunately we are right out of time for today. So thank you to our guest Lo Key, and of course our resident expert Professor David Miller. So until next time, when Palestine Declassified, we'll be back with more forensic investigations and analysis. This is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is IRIB English Radio. Here is Viewpoints. I'm Hadi Sarawi, your host. In the history of mankind, there are people who want to oppress others. In the society or all around us, we can find examples of it. Sometimes we fight back, sometimes we quit. But what do you do if you are told to give up your country? In today's episode, we are going to talk about a nation who were told to leave, but instead stayed and fought back and suffered, and lots of other things happened. Still stayed for more than 70 years. And today, after these many years, their voices are beginning to be heard. Today, we talk about a nation of courage and sacrifice, Palestine. Let's welcome our guests. Dear brother Ali, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, this is awesome to have you here with us. And Dr. Rouhani, like always, welcome.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Yeah, this is great to have you here. We are seeing that the different incidents are happening in the world. People from Palestine have returned stronger than before, and they're fighting back. Do you think, let me ask you this way, should they continue this way? I mean, so many people are being killed.
Yeah.
Shouldn't sit together, isn't it time to sit together and talk? And or losing lives is the only way?
Well, this is a good question, bro. Look, when a right is being violated, then the only way to take back your right is to defend, and is to try your best. Mm-hmm. In the last